Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
Get ready for the Corinth Comic Con this November 8th at the Crossroads Arena. Meet special guest Jimmy Walker from Good Times and more. With over 100 vendor spaces, wrestling show, and so much more for the whole family. For tickets and info, go to CorinthComicCon.com.
This is Gerard Gibbert, and thank you for listening to Middays here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert is on the air. Middays with Gerard Gibbert is powered by C Spire. Power your home or business with C Spire fiber. To learn more, visit supertalk.fm/C Spire. C Spire fiber powers Super Talk Mississippi.
Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. Hello. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Everyone, and welcome to Midday Super Talk Mississippi. I'm your host, Gerard Gibbert, along with Rhino in the Element Well Studio, guiding you through the middle of your day with facts, fodder, and fine music. Morning, Rhino.
Howdy, howdy.
It's Palmer Home Week. We got the Radiothon coming up this Thursday, and we'll be on the air 9 to 1. An extra hour of Middays in store for you. And, of course, the goal is to raise a whole bunch of money for the kids, and that's what we're going to be doing. So get ready, folks. I'm going to be calling your name out, imploring you to make a donation, because it really is for a fantastic organization, and I'm so proud of this company for its involvement in the Palmer Home for Children. What a great philanthropic gesture on the part of Super Talk Mississippi. I can't think of a better organization to provide assistance to and provide the power of this network to reach so many people. And one thing we know, Rhino, is Mississippians incredibly generous, because every year we think, how are we going to hit that number? And every year we do it. And I expect that to be the case this year for sure. So we're all buckled up, ready to go. We got Speaker of the House Jason White in the Element Well Studio at 10:20 today, a whole bunch of stuff to talk about. The market's feeling a little queasy about the tariff situation. The Dow down 271. The NASDAQ also in the red. All the indexes are. The S&P, the NASDAQ down 150. The funny money's actually up a little bit.
Not unusual. It's down from its highs, but yeah, it's still up around 108.
Sort of defying, I guess, the going against the rest of the market. But the president says he sent letters out. I think he said 12 countries, if I'm not mistaken, and telling them, you need to get your act together and come to the table to negotiate. These letters, they're going out today. Quote, I signed some letters and they'll go out on Monday. He was asked about this over the weekend, his tariff plans. And the expectation is that these countries are going to respond and start negotiating. That's the expectation at this point. Of course, you remember in April, the president announced a 10% base tariff rate and additional amounts for most countries, some as high as 50%. And the period ends July 9th. So he says the tariffs could be even higher, up to 70%. Most of those expected to go into place August the 1st. But the letters that he sent are kind of unilateral adjustments to tariffs. Quote, different amounts of money, different amounts of tariffs. I don't know that I've seen, Rhino, a list of the countries that received letters, but I'm sure that it's some in the European Union, probably Asia. He also announced a breakthrough deal with Vietnam. And that, I think, provided some reason to celebrate a bit in the markets. But these letters going out have got them a little uneasy. I haven't seen the latest data, the latest numbers on these devastating, catastrophic floods. Man, what a sad story that is. I mean, that's just as heartbreaking as it gets, especially when you're just dealing with innocent children, unsuspecting. 89, 91, I think, the death toll last I saw, of which 30-some-odd are minors or children. And you were talking this morning about the countless stories of bravery and heroics, which just restores your faith in humanity. There's just a lot of good people in this country. And Boy Scouts, the Cajun Navy, emergency
responders.
Yeah, there
were stories out of kind of the boys' camp opposite of the girls' camp, that there were some Eagle Scouts that were either bunk leaders or chaperones or something like that, but they were at the camp, and they were getting boys up into the rafters as the cabins were kind of floating and flooding, and then managed to help them get out and get to safety.
Yep.
And then there was the story of the Coast Guard rescue swimmer that was picking up kids. The story I read said at sometimes going back and forth from the kids to the helicopter, he'd have two kids under one arm, and he would be sure to reassure the other kids remaining behind, look, I'm coming right back for you. And some of the only things they were worried about was whether or not they could bring their stuffed animal, and he was, of course, telling them, of course you can.
Man. It's so sad. Over 50 still missing, I believe. Search and rescue efforts still underway. Those are being hampered somewhat by the expectation of more rain in the area. And I saw kind of an analysis, a weather analysis. This is the remnants of a tropical storm, right? That just got sandwiched between other weather systems. The high that we're enjoying that's creating fair weather with hot temperatures because it's July is preventing that system to move forward, and it's just dumping rain. That's what happened.
Similar thing happened a couple of years ago where it was the metro area that really got impacted.
Yeah, exactly.
Metro of Houston,
that is. I remember that. The big Houston flood. It's a huge deal. I got an old college buddy that operates Ace Hardware stores in the area, and he was sold everything he had, of course. Something like that. And I remember him going online and, you know, just appealing to people to help the residents of his community, because he couldn't. You know, he couldn't get any more product. Everything had been scarfed up. So, yeah, that seems like forever ago, but it wasn't that long ago. That was a huge, huge story. Because areas that had flooded that traditionally have not. I mean, we hadn't really seen anything. Another unprecedented sort of deal.
Yeah.
Right. So in the meantime, up in Washington there, of course, the President of the United States had a huge ceremony with jets flying overhead, signing the big, beautiful bill. That all happened when we were off on July 4th. How fitting. Of course, the Senate and the House worked on the legislation. Finally passed through the Senate, passed through the House with some amendments in the Senate. The House pretty much accepted it as is, got it to the President's desk for signature. The fear-mongering from the Democrats is getting long in the tooth. Is that a fair way to describe it?
The nicest way to put it.
I think it's ridiculous, honestly, and I get that they're trying to salvage what they can of their party and leverage what they perceive to be as all the negatives in their legislation, mainly focused on health care and all the people who are going to lose health care coverage, and a high degree of focus on that. I know I sent you some videos that I ran across over the weekend. We'll try to get to those later on in the program, but again, I just got to say, this idea that these reforms were necessary to preserve tax cuts for the wealthy is such a misrepresentation and just a farce. That essentially suggests that the two are inextricably linked. They may be from a legislative perspective to pass legislation through a simple majority in the Senate through the reconciliation rules, because those have to fit within all sorts of economic and financial constraints and parameters. But does this not suggest that those who earn and contribute, earn money and contribute to the Treasury, are obligated to provide health care and food and housing assistance? I mean, like, you're obligated, compelled, dictated. That's what it suggests to me. And when they go on these rants, Rhino, these Democrats, and say, this is the largest transfer of wealth from the lower classes to the upper classes in history. What are they talking about? There's no transfer of wealth. They should be thanking these people for funding what they have. Unbelievable.
Well, if a Democrat's mouth is moving, you're pretty much assured they're lying.
I'm sick of this sort of just default expectation that a small number of people in this country got to provide benefits for a huge number of people. Speaker of the House Jason White is next.
Hey, this is Bob.
This segment of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by Covington County Hospital in Collins, where your health matters.
Now back to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays from the Element Well Studio. Thanks so much for joining us. The Speaker of the House just informed me he's walking in right now. Quick question on the ceasefire text line while the Speaker is getting seated, and it concerns the overtime provisions in the bill. Rhino, you see that, and I just want to clarify that because I know there's a whole bunch of confusion on that. So you don't have to itemize to take advantage of the deduction on overtime and tips. That it's in what's called an above-the-line deduction. However, one thing to keep in mind with respect to the overtime, only the premium portion of overtime is deductible. So your full overtime pay is not, your base pay is not, just the premium portion. Just wanted to clarify that. We're pleased to welcome now Speaker of the House, Jason White. Good to see you, Mr. Speaker.
Good to be with you, Gerard.
Yes,
sliding in here on a Monday morning.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we appreciate you coming for sure. I know you've been very busy. Even when you guys are out of session, you're still working pretty hard.
We've been busy.
Yeah.
We've kind of found some of our best work and most deliberate work happens when we're not in session.
Sure.
Which was, I probably had not fully appreciated that before my time in this role.
Okay.
As I do now, for sure.
Well, as an example, you just announced some select committees, four to be exact, that are focused on various areas of government that are complex and require lots of research and study and analysis, and I think the expectation, don't want to speak on your behalf, but the expectation is these legislators, these members of your House, are going to come back with some recommendations.
I think they will. And you mentioned all those things, those aspects that those committees offer. Left one out. They also give us an opportunity to build some consensus.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Like, let's figure out, you know, is everybody – how do we feel? Are you good with this? You know, where we don't just get there and it's a free-for-all food fight come January.
Well, not only that. You've got the pressure of the compressed amount of time and when you're in session, and they go have these committee meetings, and there's a lot of pressure. We got to get all these bills addressed and out and, you know, make some decisions here. And it's just hard when
it's
you
hard.
Think about the volume that we compress in that short period of time.
It's hard. And then you throw the budgetary factor on top of that.
Yeah.
And it's a lot. So this formula has kind of worked for us, you know, our first 2 years. You know,
okay.
we We focused on a few big things and were able to get those things across the finish line. And this was kind of the formula for it was, hey, let's get our most folks within our, not only the Republican caucus, but the House at large that are passionate on this issue, whatever side of the issue they are on this particular thing. Let's get them all in the room because they're more focused on it maybe than some other members. So let's start there. And so that's how the makeup of these select committees you see. Now the makeup of the Metro Revitalization Committee, the Jackson Committee, for lack of a better term, that was made up of mostly Metro lawmakers, either Jackson or surrounding areas. There are a few from the hinterlands, but most of those people were made up. That committee was a lot to do with geography.
Okay.
The rest of them, though, were individuals, different House members who had indicated, you know, hey, I'm – or either by their actions. They didn't even have to say or ask. Their actions indicated how – plugged in they were on some of these other issues. For instance, education, and that'll be – we'll spend a lot of time and attention, you know, this off season and I think in the session on that issue that I'm calling education freedom. But, you know, I'm not afraid to say the word school choice. That's going to be a major component of what we're talking about. But it's not the only one. And when I spoke at Stennis Press last week, they were – I think they thought, I said, oh, you're following the one big beautiful bill mantra and throwing everything in. I said, no, they followed us. We had House Bill 1, which threw the kitchen sink in there. So they followed us, right? No, I know they didn't care what Mississippi was doing. But
let's stay on the topic of school choice, and I'm going to call it that as well, as I always have, and appreciate your honesty and your candor there. You're somewhat familiar, and if you're not, that's fine, with the provision in the Big Beautiful Bill that is significant, honestly.
Right.
And just for the folks out there, and what this is, people, is private entities can set up programs that take in donations from private individuals, or it could be from companies, but limited to $1,700 a year that is an offset, a dollar-for-dollar tax credit at the federal level.
That's
so this
correct.
Is a federal
taxpayer.
Tax credit.
That's
per
right.
taxpayer, $1,700, and then that private organization then doles out scholarships, if you will, for private school tuition and some other education expenses as well. The rules haven't been and the policies haven't been detailed yet, but that's the concept. But here's the key thing before you start, Mr. Speaker. Each state has to opt into the program.
That's number one. That was a key negotiation or I won't say a give. It would have been considered a give if I'd been sitting at the table. But but to get their votes, they had to do what they had to do to get the votes. And so all of a sudden that – because before it was, if this passes, this is how
law
it is.
Law of the land, all 50
and now
states.
It's, so you would have to pass what I'm calling a trigger. In other words, you would have to pass something that just says we're opting in. We are going to allow this in our state, number one. But number two, there seems to be a lot of confusion about some people were saying, oh, well, $1,700. But it's per taxpayer that can be aggregated in that organization you're talking about. For instance, there are nonprofits. There are people. These things exist in other parts of our country that already have a non-governmental scholarship organization that people apply there because some of this is funded by private money or other foundations like in other states in other ways. There are scholarship organizations. This one would be kind of a new entity for us here in that they would aggregate these $1,700 credits if folks would donate specifically to theirs.
Right.
And I guess they have to go out and work that. It takes a little time to build their name ID and say, hey, we're doing this and we have a track record or we don't, you know, that sort of thing. But those could be doled out. And if you look at – and again, here's another feature – 300% of the federal poverty level is the federal
to be eligible.
To be eligible, you've got to be under that. That would get a huge. We were looking at it early this morning in the office. Cole Butler in my office is really plugged in, and he runs point on a lot of this policy. About 27, almost 28% of Mississippi public school students of the 440,000 to 50,000 that we have in public school, almost 28% of them are at 100% of the federal poverty level.
Okay.
Now, you triple that, which would be about $93,000 for a family of four in Mississippi.
Yeah, I was thinking about $100,000.
Yeah, 93 or 4 if we were running, give or take.
Okay.
That's going to get a huge percentage of kids. Now, you know, how much could families – I've seen one estimate that you could – if you had robust participation of the 1,700 per taxpayer in Mississippi, in other words, if a bunch of taxpayers participated and made that donation and elected to take that tax credit dollar for dollar, if you will, it could throw as much as what, $100 million? I saw some figure.
Yeah,
you know, and you could get 18,000 kids and at $6,500 a pop. I saw one of the math exercises there. I don't know that we'll get that much robust participation. We'll see.
Well, so let's think about this. Because this is a federal tax credit, I didn't see anything in the bill that would preclude someone who doesn't live in Mississippi,
that's correct,
right, to donate to a program in Mississippi.
That's correct. I could see, because you've seen some college scholarship organizations do this. I had a classmate who worked for a company, and he's in different major city every week at places where folks go that have acquired a lot of wealth that are looking to be philanthropic and what they might do. You know,
yeah.
He knows where to hit and which,
yeah,
symposium,
sure,
that sort of thing. Yeah, yeah, you could shop it that way. I just saw an estimate of 100. And, I
yeah.
think I saw 110 million could be a potential target and what that would do. Who knows what we could get. But, yeah, yeah, it wouldn't have to be Mississippi taxpayers for Mississippi. Yeah, this isn't your grandparents putting this on their tax return so that the grandkid gets the $1,700. It's
right.
not that.
Right.
And that seemed to be some people thinking, oh, well, you mean I'm just going to get to write off up to $1,700 of the private school tuition I already paid? No, it's not that. It's not any of that. It's what you've already described, which could still be a game changer for us. But it will take a vote to opt in, number one.
Yeah. So – So I got to ask you, handicap that for me. Do you think that would the state would vote to opt it in, that our legislature, that such a measure would pass both houses?
I'll
governor would sign it.
I think certainly the governor would sign it. I think it will pass in the House with flying colors. Now, I can't speak for the state Senate these days or most any day, so I'll let you ask them when you see and talk to them.
I understand.
I think it would be incredibly short-sighted not to take advantage of something, because the number one issue I hear from Republicans who say they're against this is we can't afford it. They say,
yeah,
we can't afford 50,000 kids going to private school.
This isn't state money.
Yeah, hundreds of millions of dollars. We can't do it. So this takes that off the table,
yep,
Gerard, right,
yep,
off the bat.
So I'm with
so
you.
We'd have to carve out another excuse not to get there on that part.
So before we go to a break, can you hang with us?
Yeah, sure.
So before we go to break, I want to go on record right now. I'm in for $1,700. We're coming right back with the Speaker of the House, Jason White.
From the SeabrookPaint.com with us.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert, here on Super Talk Mississippi.
We're back with you in the Element Well studio, visiting with Speaker of the House of Representatives of Mississippi, Jason White. So, Mr. Speaker, let's backtrack a little bit. Major accomplishment during the legislative session was the big tax reform bill, of course, that was kind of a big, beautiful bill, as you've described, from a state perspective. Some of those provisions went into effect July 1.
They did.
Increase in the fuel tax at 3 cents per gallon. It's an excise tax, and then that will continue in 3 cents increments for the succeeding 2 years, and then adjusted for construction cost inflation after that. And then, of course, we had a reduction in the sales tax on groceries. And best I can tell, seems like everybody focuses on what went up and doesn't take anything into account on what went down.
Well, you're correct. 7 to 5 on the groceries and 3% increase in the excise
3 cents.
Tax.
3 yep. cents.
And it'll be 3
Not
cents.
Not 3%. 3 cents.
3 cents.
Yep.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that's what
you
I said.
Said
but if I
you
didn't,
said percent, but that's fine. I got
3
you.
Cents. No, it's a flat. It's 3 cents on the 18.4 that's there.
Yep.
And I had one House member text me. He was very attuned to this. He'd heard from several he has a couple of trucking companies in his district, different things. So some guys had, you know, talked to him about this bill specifically. And so he was watching just in his area, the gas pumps in his town and in his community. And the day it went into effect, so we're watching for that 3 cents, gas went down 10 cents. Now, I understand it'll go up somewhere, someday, sometime. But my point is, it was time for us to do that. You were on an 1987 highway program funding model that could not exist. You couldn't run your computer company on a 1987 budget. We couldn't run the legislature. We couldn't run the state. We couldn't run public education on 1987 dollars. It was time for us to make an adjustment there. And Brad White, our executive director, who had been so helpful in getting this done, I'll put his conservative bona fides up against anybody's most any day. He's a former chairman of chief of staff for several of our senators and governors and at the state party. And he was like, Jason, it's past time. We need to do something here. So it was conservative. It didn't go as far, really, as the House wanted to go. So it's a total of a 9 cent increase, as you said, and a 3 year phase in. But it will finally put us on a path to fixing some of our crumbling infrastructure, and we don't go through a process where we're closing hundreds of bridges like we did just a few years ago.
To those who say that the Department of Transportation needs further scrutiny and audit of expenditures, that more money could be saved there, which would negate the need for this increase. So how do you respond?
Well, a couple of things. Audits happen every day at MDOT, and our state auditor, I would submit, does a really good job of looking at all sorts of things, including, you know, what he terms waste, fraud, and abuse, and waste being the number one thing there. And so I hadn't heard him sound a specific alarm as to that, but I'll take you back. Early in my legislative career, this was probably 10 years ago, a guy by the name of Gary Chisholm, who was chairman of insurance, but he really had a burr under his saddle about MDOT and their budget and what was going on over there. He spent an entire offseason, almost 9 months, full access, the commissioner, the executive director at the time, come on. Gary took some of his most engaged fellow lawmakers, and he was involved in peer and other things going on. And it just wasn't there. It just wasn't there. Now, could you single out a position here or this here or that there, but the truth is we've lost that engineering capacity that they had because the private sector pays so much more and they hire those folks away. We kind of run a bare bones MDOT. A lot of people don't want to hear that. They don't believe it because it's a huge monetary item, you know, in our budget. So much of it is federal money too, but
more than 2/3 of it.
Highway construction and maintenance is incredibly expensive, and it, you know, as my kids say sometimes, Dad, it costs what it costs. That costs what it costs. Whether you're resurfacing a mile, and I won't pretend to be a road builder or engineer or any of that by any stretch. But I do understand the incredibly complex and expensive deal that goes with that and the manpower involved in maintaining it. I would tell you he runs a pretty tight ship over there.
So the last time I checked, Mr. Speaker, and I talked to Brad about this as well. The vast majority of the actual maintenance and construction is outsourced, is contracted,
correct,
to third parties.
That's right. That's right.
And it's all done through competitive bid process.
That's correct.
So they're kind of limited on what you can do there, other than make sure you're running a tight bid process.
Right, and that was what Gary, Representative Chisholm, Chairman Chisholm, really focused on, and he had the respect of a lot of Republican, extremely conservative members when it came to that. And he came back and said, "Guys, girls, look,
yeah,
I've looked, I've checked the couch cushions. This is a pretty lean operation."
Yeah.
He didn't come in and find we needed to pass or call them on the carpet at the next budget hearing because of these things. It wasn't that. And I'm not saying it doesn't always mean we shouldn't be looking for ways to be more accountable
in every agency
with taxpayer money and transparent.
Yeah.
I'm all for that. And I just think it's easy to say they're wasting money. I saw three guys leaning on a shovel. I'm not saying you can't find those isolated incidents here and there, but by and large, they're running a pretty lean ship over there now.
And honestly, again, the vast majority of it's going to third parties.
Yep.
It's not being consumed by the department itself.
That's correct.
And that needs to be taken into consideration. And we really can't control what the competitive landscape looks like there. And, you know, a lot of companies have stopped bidding on these projects MDOT.
They have. And plus, so much came either through, you know, the American Rescue Plan or pandemic recovery, things like that. A lot of money flowed here, and a bunch of that, most governmental entities, you know, before we decided at some parts of the capital that funding local infrastructure was a bad thing, most of the money we directed that came to us from the feds went to local governments with the stipulation it had to go to infrastructure.
That's right.
And besides water and sewer, most of it went to roads and bridges. But because of that, there's a whole bunch of that on the books to be done, and contractors' plates are full right now.
PBM reform. That has been a very controversial, it's extremely complicated issue, as you well know. And I know you've consumed lots of input from both sides of that argument. And we had somebody last week that is just demanding that you guys take some action with respect to this, which kind of sounded to me like they want government to pass law that would sort of dictate price controls. Where do you stand on this today?
They do. And for us, first off, those folks that are very upset with me, for some reason the bad cloud has stopped on me. But hey, that comes with the territory and the job, and I'll take it. They framed the argument: you're either for independence or you're for the PBMs. Nobody's for the PBMs. Now, I hadn't found a person yet. Man, woman, Republican, Democrat at the legislature on either end of the building that is there to protect the interest of the PBMs. Nobody's there to do that. I would tell you, we didn't create the PBMs. And pharmacists, both independents and National Change and everybody, operated for a long time with PBMs.
Right.
Everybody else was wondering what in the world's going on. You know, everybody was doing just fine with PBMs as far as in the industry. The rebates were flowing. Everything was good. It was after PBMs got vertically integrated and said, hey, we can skin this cat another way. We'll not only get into figuring out the formularies and prices and all that, we'll sell drugs ourselves. And that created a conflict that most people can see now. Is that capitalism?
Well,
can you
address that at the state level, though? Because you get to a point where it becomes antitrust, and I think we could agree on that. But is that something the state can do anything about? Or is that a federal matter?
Typically, we have not.
Okay.
We just, on most things, you let the market work. Now,
sure.
I would have to back up, because on this issue, what separates it from other issues for me is, to some extent, it is healthcare, and while we might all wish for that this was a private sector deal and that the market was sorted out, as you know and have explained better than most talking heads that I hear, Gerard, I'll give you some credit here, it is incredibly complex because the government got involved. For better or worse, they got involved, and we are neck deep in it now. And because of that, I have to hear what the independents are saying when they're saying, look,
sure,
we are being cut out of this deal in every way, and it's unfair. It is unfair. So for us, how do we find a solution that doesn't just result in the PBMs and insurance raising prices on our Mississippi businesses and the consumer, the taxpayer, the person who's paying that insurance ultimately? It's got to fall somewhere, because PBMs hadn't, to this point, been in the business of taking less money. So it's going to come out of somebody's pocket if we're not incredibly smart about how we do it. And some of the reforms that they've asked us to pass to this point have been challenged immediately in court in other states now. And the response has been, I hear the music, but has been, well, we get sued before we passed. We do. We just need to be smart about how we do it and not just pass on a cost to Mississippi businesses or consumers themselves. And so that's why we've been cautious about it. I think that's the right approach. I hope we get somewhere.
You got to go?
I can hang out.
Okay. Yeah, we got one more segment. I got to ask you about the big, beautiful bill's impact on SNAP and Medicaid in Mississippi. Coming right back with Speaker of the House, Jason White.
Super. You're listening to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
We're back with you in the Element Well studio. We're talking to Speaker of the House Jason White. So one of the aspects of the big, beautiful bill that has got states scurrying around doing all the math, we were just doing it on the break here, is the SNAP program. A couple of reforms there. That's used to be called food SNAPs, of course. Food stamps, of course. Is that states currently pay 50% of the administrative costs, not the actual benefits themselves. That would change, and that states would be required to pick up 75%. And then there's some penalties based on the error rate. And by the way, the error rate is just the administrative error rate, folks. This does not take into consideration any fraud. And in the bill, an error rate above 6%, it would require the states to actually pick up some of the benefit cost. Last I checked, Mississippi's error rate is about 12%.
Yeah, it's about double that.
Yep. So I guess the bottom line, Mr. Speaker, and I know you guys will be hashing all this out when you get together, is this could pose additional spending and costs on the state of Mississippi.
It could. It could. As it relates to that. Now, we'll have to really drill down on what that error rate looks like, how that's calculated, what we're doing to address that, or lack thereof, as
yeah.
you say.
Yeah.
Our folks over there have been, you know, we'll have to figure that out. But that is a feature. That is something that it will have immediate financial, you know, realities for us because of that particular feature of the bill. Which again, though, that is, you know, I tell folks who get all bent out of shape about it, I'm like, this is what we voted for, was moving somewhere toward government, toward common sense, with more transparency, less waste, less fraud, less abuse of the system. That's what people finally had enough of. So, you know, I think Mississippi, we're going to do our part, and we'll embrace it, and we'll figure it out and move forward. Now, we have a lot of people that receive those benefits.
It's 384,000.
You just look them up.
Yeah.
That's more than 10% of our state. So it's real for people, and not necessarily affect their benefits as much as it's going to affect the cost to the taxpayer in Mississippi
sure.
to deliver those services, yeah. if you will.
From a Medicaid perspective, not too much effect on us because we didn't expand, but Mississippi, like virtually every other state, does finance part of its Medicaid program through what are called provider taxes. These are just taxes on health care providers. And the federal government said, okay, and that's currently limited to 6% of the total program.
Right.
Those that expanded are going to have to back that down to 3.5%. We didn't. We're safe at 6%. But the prospect of using provider taxes for any future idea of expansion is off the table now. We can't do that under
yeah,
this bill.
And there were some major, you know, our not our state medical association, really hadn't heard from them on the issue. They hadn't been engaged. But the hospital association has been, and certainly their objective is to look out for Mississippi hospitals, and they've got a specific branch that looks out for rural hospitals. And the concern had been there about the enhanced reimbursements that we get from that, because without those, and we use, you know, bed taxes or provider taxes to draw down those federal dollars.
Yeah.
And there was lots of conversation as that bill was being debated and kicked around that that some of that may be tightened up on to the point of, you know, if we were to lose the enhanced reimbursements that the governor's team and Drew Snyder and them came up with in the fall of 23, I believe November of 23.
Yep.
Those things essentially saved a certain number of our rural hospitals. Now, some of them, even that wasn't enough to save them. And we'll have to adjust as that goes forward. But my point is, that's a really delicate balance there, again, because government is so involved and entrenched in our health care and the way we do it. You and I wouldn't set it up that way, and I've received a lot of criticism for looking at it from that standpoint. But my point is, I don't like it that way, but that's the world we exist in, and until somebody, you know, and maybe it takes an administration like the one we have in D.C. now being willing to blow it up a little bit and maybe not start over, but blow it up to the point where we could start over and run it more like a business. But that is not the model you have now. And so when I hear folks sometimes they call me or come to see me or send me a letter, and they've got a simple solution. I said, that'd be great if the feds and government wasn't so involved in it.
Yeah. So we're at risk, the last calculation I did, of losing $150 million a year in those enhanced payments that you were talking about. But there's also a $50 billion rural health care fund that they had to sort of bribe Senator Murkowski in Alaska to get her vote passed. I mean, you know how that stuff works.
Tell folks you don't want to see the sausage being made.
Oh,
especially
man.
Successful business people.
Exactly. Ms. Speaker, appreciate you coming in.
Thank you for the time, Jar. It's been good to be with you.
Speaker of the House, Jason White, has been our guest in the Element Well studio. Middays is coming back after Fox News and Super Talk News.
Hour of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by the Mississippi Business Journal. Visit msbusinessjournal.com. Scott Coopwood, publisher and president.
Welcome to the show that challenges you to think deeply, and look beyond political posturing. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. It's a Monday. It's a short show. We're live in the Element Wealth studio. We appreciate you joining us today, as always. And, of course, we appreciate Speaker of the House, Jason White, for coming in the Element Wealth studio and spending some time with us. Covered a lot of ground there, I thought. We could have gone on with more conversation. A whole lot going on. But he was just checking the numbers, by the way, when he was getting seated, when he came in the studio, about concerning our revenue. Looks like we hit the sine die estimate for fiscal year 2025, which just ended June 30th. So that's good news. That revenue was on target. Spending, of course, within the constraints of what was appropriated. So looks like we're set to produce a tidy surplus again, $550 million plus, almost to $600 million. That's good news for the state of Mississippi. Remember that the individual income tax rate, there's only one bracket remaining. That's all taxable income above $10,000. During this calendar year, that's taxed at 4.4%. That will decline to 4% in calendar year 2026. And then, of course, the bill that passed this session kicks in, and that would have been HB1 there. And the income tax rate will further decrement in quarter percent portions for the subsequent 4 years, 27, 28, 29, 30, taking it down to 3% over that four-year period. And then there's some triggers applied, but due to, for future reductions in the rate, but due to a drafting error that's rather infamous now, I would say, Rhino, I don't think we're going to have any problem hitting the threshold, because based on the drafting error, it simply means that the projection of revenue over expenses is a whopping $4 million. Yes, with an M as in Mike. $4 million in a $7 billion budget. That's like less than petty cash. So we'll, I think, easily achieve that. And that will result in a reduction of the rate by 0.3%. Starting at 3%, it'll be 0.3% over 10 years, till it finally phases out to zero. Now, the expectation, of course, is that This will spur economic growth. And through that economic growth, there will be sufficient increase in sales tax revenues. Sales tax revenues, individual income taxes, the two primary sources of revenue to the state of Mississippi, about 60% total revenue into the state coffers comes from those two sources, sales taxes, individual income taxes. So the expectation is with the economic growth, you'll see a boost in sales taxes, more consumption, an increase in sales taxes. Now, I did a little math on this. I did this at both the federal level and the state level. Because if the expectation and the projection is that economic growth will produce more revenue, and I totally believe that it does. We've witnessed it with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act passed in 2017, that will, again, produce more revenue, and that will offset the elimination or the reduction in the income tax, reduction for a while and then ultimate elimination. So once it's fully eliminated, if everything else stays the same, there's some calculations you can do on what's called the tax to GDP ratio. It's a common metric used in shaping tax policy and other fiscal policies, tax to GDP. The state's GDP, check me on this, Rhino. Last I remember researching, about $120 billion, as I recall, something like that. Total GDP for the state of Mississippi.
So, yeah, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, Mississippi's real GDP in 2024 was $122.438 billion.
Okay, 122. All right. So if you think about the income taxes,
grew by 4.2%.
Yeah, which is really good. I mean, we have we've been in the news, honestly, nationally for the surge in our GDP growth, which is a good thing. So, if you look at the total amount of sales taxes collected in the state, just doing the quick math on that, I believe that was $2.8 billion last year. So that's what, about 3%? Maybe not quite 3% because it's $122 million. So just thinking about the ratio of sales taxes to GDP. Yeah. 2.3%. I said 2.3%. I think it's the way that math works out. So if you think about economic growth as a way to replace the income tax. So the income tax in the state last year was $2.1 billion. So the 2.1 as a percentage of our GDP was 1.8%. And where, with all this math, where I'm going here is how much do we have to grow our GDP? How much economic growth do we have to sustain to make up for the income tax revenue loss? Assuming, of course, that expenses stay the same, spending stays relatively level, and it won't. It will just naturally, through inflation, it will go up. Education, Medicaid, which consume about 70% of total spending at the state level. But you can kind of do the math there. That means we need about $100 billion more of GDP. So we'd have to go from 122 to 222 over that period. Is that possible? Sure, it's possible. It's ambitious, and I hope we achieve it. And the same exercise can be done at the federal level. So it turns out that revenue to the federal government has been fairly consistently, I mean, for decades, at about 17% of GDP. I was a little shocked to find out just how level it's been through the years. 17%. So same thing there with the economic growth, if the idea and the goal is for economic growth to help us trim deficits, it, with $2.1 trillion deficits and 17% tax rate ratio to GDP, we need to grow our GDP from the present level of $29 trillion to about $44 trillion. That's assuming spending stays level, which it won't. Because the last time we did the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you remember in 2017, we did in fact see a significant increase in revenue, despite what the Democrats like to talk about. And they always blame all the deficits on the lowering taxes, which is just complete horse hockey. So it did go up by about 33%. The problem is the spending went up 55%. So just kind of looking at both the federal and the state level, sorry to get so off into the weeds on the numbers, but this is what we're going to be faced with at the federal level and the state level. This is what the idea and the goal is to spur economic growth. It's going to have to be a bunch of it. And I hope that happens, man, because we'll all be significantly wealthier if we achieve that level of economic growth. I mean, can you imagine the GDP in the state almost doubling over a 10-year period? That would be fantastic. I mean, that'd just be incredible. That means we're just cranking.
Yeah, especially considering we're already ahead of most of the major European countries in per capita GDP as a state.
Because their policies of socialism have devastated what should be a far more productive set of countries from an economic perspective. You know the bottom line is? They're freaking lazy. You're shaking it. You know that's right. They're more about their leisure time than they are working. I get the work-life balance, but they skewed it in the direction of the life way more than work. And that's why their GDP sucks and their economy sucks. Coming right back, that's a great tune, Firefall. Stay with us.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Let's do this.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Let's go.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, dig it.
Stop right on.
Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Hey, Father, Father.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. That's the great Marvin Gaye. So, I walk in the coffee shop this morning, and that tune's playing. Now, that's from 60s. I don't remember the year. Maybe it was 70, something like that.
71.
Okay, 71. Well, that's right in the middle of the Vietnam War, of course. Ended in 72. Sort of ended in 72. What a disaster that deal was, evacuating Hanoi. And the young folks there in the coffee shop, I just happened to share with them a question. Do you know what the underlying message in this song is? And they didn't know. They didn't know who Marvin Gaye was. A couple of them did. Everybody didn't. And it's a protest song. This is about the Vietnam War, just turmoil in society, social and political at the time. It's really a commentary on social injustice, poverty, race, a little bit on environmental concerns as well. I just, drug abuse, I mean, all the issues of the time that were plaguing the country. And And even though sometimes, you know, Rhino, there are a lot of doom and gloomers out there that just seem to be just constantly leaning into everything bad and how terrible, and most recently all the Democrats with the big, beautiful bill, you would just think people are right out there on the streets today, like just dying, right? That's what they would have you believe, all for personal political gain, which is disgusting. But I got to tell you, there are a lot of people in this country, and I was young, man, that really thought it was the end of the world in 68, 69, that period of time with the Vietnam War and all the other turmoil. But we survived it, and we emerged a stronger country. Now, there's no doubt that's a stain on our past, in my view, the Vietnam War. We didn't know what the heck we were there for. We didn't give our brave members of the military the resources, the assets they needed to fight effectively and win the war. It's a bad deal. And then, of course, when they returned, they were not welcomed to the fanfare we saw after World War II, for example. And that's kind of sad. It's not kind of sad. It's very sad. They just did what their country asked them to do. And I remember as a youngster, my brother was in the Air Force, and my family in 68 traveled to where he was based in California, Beale Air Force Base, north of San Francisco, Marysville, California area. And I remember going through as a youngster, grade school, middle school, going through the airport there in San Francisco, SFO, and there were just a bunch of organized protesters there to greet those returning from war because they fly them back commercially through the airports so they could yell at them and demean them and degrade them, spit on them. These were soldiers. They just did a job.
Soldiers, the majority of whom were drafted.
Right. And didn't want to go, to your point. And if you ask them, what are you there for? There are interviews, countless interviews. Well, I don't know. They tell us we're here for, like, fighting communism or something, but we're not really sure. I mean, so a war without objectives, without any clear goals, just felt like it was commercialized. I know I'm digressing a lot here on something that's pretty old, but there are a lot of similarities to today when you look at the protesters that are out there. And that was the most egregious form because, again, these were just young kids, man, that many of whom didn't make it home. The statistic is well known now, the average age, 19. I think there's even a couple of protest songs about that, if I'm not mistaken. The age of 19. 55,000 perished in the Vietnam War, Americans that are, of course, recognized on the famous wall. And it took forever to get a wall built to recognize. The country kind of wanted to forget it. And it's a sad part of our history. But we all thought, man, the world's coming to an end. But we survived. We're resilient. And all this hyperbole coming out of the left today, get over it, man. I sent Rhino a clip of a University of Minnesota professor that unfortunately, toward the end there, had to use an expletive that we cannot play on the air. Why they think all their communications has to include that? Can they not have a conversation without that? Can they not deliver a message without dropping F-bombs? I don't want to pretend to be a prude here. Far from it. But that kind of stuff, maybe I'm old-fashioned, that's among the guys in the locker room. Not in public.
Well, the left doesn't understand locker room talk.
I guess so. Maybe they don't. But bottom line, the message here from this lunatic, who's a tenured professor at a major university in this country.
You'll find the vast majority of them are lunatics.
She's calling for, we've got to dismantle the United States. We will not survive unless we decolonize. And you know how I feel about that word. As soon as I heard that, okay, you're done. You have zero credibility. She's teaching kids in college. She represents a big swath of them. That's what's disturbing. She's not unique. She's not an aberration. She's typical. Man, that aggravated me so bad listening to that. So the sky's falling. We got to dismantle the country because we want people to go work to get SNAP benefits. Unbelievable how they've played that up. It's incredible. And they will, you know this, when the midterms approaches, you know they're going to parade out every freaking hardship case, even those that aren't hardships, even those who are not entitled to those benefits legitimately. And you know there's a bunch of them. They're going to parade them out and make the biggest deal out of that to try to tug at voters' heartstrings. Look at what the Republicans did. And it's a complete farce, and it's despicable that our politics have gotten to that point. Totally.
I mean, just look at how they've lionized Maryland Man.
Unbelievable. That's exactly right.
The dude literally had a hand in human trafficking, but no, he's a Maryland man.
Unbelievable. So, I just received a text from a good friend that's listening. Said, my dad was in the Air Force during Vietnam. Went through the same protest in California on his way home from Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. Said people spit on him. Yeah, so.
It's almost like California's always been full of crazy people.
But, you know.
And worthless wastes of space.
Well, let's be honest. People travel from all over the country to hang out at San Francisco International Airport to be part of those protests. But, and of course, what they don't get, that they never will appreciate or understand, is that the people they're spitting on are the very ones who would sacrifice their lives to protect their right to spit on them. Is that not true?
Yep.
That's totally true. Only in this country. Man, they don't deserve the freedom that those who sacrifice for it provide. They really don't. That's what I call abuse of it. I support their right to do it. They're stupid. They're disgusting. I have the right to call them out as such. I think our best days are ahead. I'm eternally optimistic. I will not buy into all the fear-mongering, and you know our audience doesn't either, coming out of the left. I do have concerns about our fiscal situation, but so what?
Well, in fairness, the only way you're ever going to get the government to cut spending is if you run them out of money.
And that's where we're headed. And so you know that there's reports from the trustees of Social Security, Medicare, the big one that dropped a bomb on the country a couple of weeks ago, says, yeah, we're running out of money faster than we thought. It looks like it's 2034. We won't be able to make full benefit payments in both programs. I think you're the one that said the other day, if I'm not mistaken, yeah, they'll start worrying about that in about 2033 and a half, right? All to protect their political hides. We need somebody that's willing to sacrifice their hide for the good of the country and say, okay, I know, you're not going to elect me next time because I made the tough decisions. That's who we need. We're coming right back. Stay with us.
From the SeabrookPaint.com.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
It is on.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Okay, so I misspoke, by the way. Not Hanoi, Saigon. I interchanged those mistakenly. I always recall the Hanoi Hilton. That's kind of infamous. But, yeah, I mean, the opening line in the song What's going on? Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. Picket line, sister, and picket sign, sister. Don't punish me, sister, with brutality, sister.
Well, I feel like at least lyrics. When I was coming up, I was done a disservice in history class. And this is not throwing shade at my history teachers. I had great history teachers. I mean, I was sitting in Coach Pugh's class when 9/11 happened, and he walked in and turned on the TV and said, we're going to watch history happen. So I had good history teachers, but the curriculum kind of skirted past Vietnam. It didn't really want to spend a whole lot of time focusing on it. So for the longest time, my understanding of the Vietnam War was that it ended with the fall of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
Except that's factually inaccurate.
Right.
Operation Rolling Thunder forced them to come to the table for a ceasefire, and we got out in 73. The fall of Saigon didn't happen for another 2+ years.
Right. It continued on. That's right. And there were a lot of people that were upset that we weren't there to further defend South Vietnam against North Vietnam. So at the end of the day, though, all of that, all that loss of life, all that expense, all the assets lost, really achieved nothing.
But the overarching narrative of Vietnam is we lost the Vietnam War. And it's like, can you really call it a loss if you hit them so hard, you make them acquiesce to all of your terms, and you leave?
Yeah, that's true.
Is that really a loss?
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it. I totally agree. DJ and Summit asks a very interesting question. Why did they increase the standard deduction of $6,000 per senior only for a few years? Why not permanent? Yeah, and
reconciliation.
The same is true with tips and overtime as well. And it's honestly, to further illustrate it, it's exactly why less than 10 years after the TCJA passed in 2017, because those bills are for 10 years, we're back at the drawing board to extend those tax cuts. And it has to do, as Rhino said, with the reconciliation, DJ. It's all the rules around what can pass in the Senate with a simple majority. And there's all kinds of math and financial machinations that go on there that the parliamentarian and the CBO and all their army of people apply to a 1,000-page bill like this to determine, yeah, that passes muster. And remember, everybody was up in arms a week and a half ago when she said, nope, can't do this, can't do that, can't do this, doesn't pass muster, this, that, and the other. Planned Parenthood is a great example. So Planned Parenthood receives $350, $400 million a year from Medicaid. Now, those funds can't be used to pay for abortions, wink, wink. You can't file a claim to Medicaid for abortion services. However, Planned Parenthood facilities provide lots of other services as well that are eligible. Pap smears, for example, for Medicaid.
And but it's the same box of gloves gets used for
Medicaid. Yeah, that's the same building, same people, same operating rooms, same exam rooms, same assets and equipment, all the common costs, all the same that are used to perform abortions. So this bill does prohibit and ban Planned Parenthood from participating in Medicaid for 1 year. Not permanently, 1 year. How could you make it permanent? Same with the deduction, DJ. How could you make it permanent? Get all Republicans and 7 Democrats in the Senate to vote for it, and you could make it permanent.
Or, and I'm confused why I haven't heard a single Republican senator come out and put it this way, vote Republican in the midterms, give them 60 plus, and they can do it.
That's absolutely true. You need 60 votes in the Senate. If you got 60 Republicans that agreed, and that's part of the problem as well. There are a lot of Republicans that aren't on board with this. They had to pull, as I was saying earlier, Murkowski off the ledge with what turns out to be a bunch of bribes for Alaska at the end of the day. She got all kinds of carve-outs. I don't like that.
You get a lot more leverage, though, if it's close to 50-50 and you're trying
agree.
To get to a tie so the VP can break it compared to, hey, we got 59. We need you. Put up or shut up.
Yeah, I agree. It's diminished when you have those kinds of numbers. Completely agree. And all you can say at that point, you got no chance of ever getting a bill passed if you don't vote for this deal, right? You get ostracized. I mean, that happens at all levels of government. So that's why it's limited. And by the way, that $6,000 additional standard deduction is only eligible for individuals who make less than $75,000 a year who are 65 or older, and those filing joint with $150,000. Otherwise, you don't get the additional standard deduction. This will increase the number on Social Security that presently don't pay federal income taxes on their Social Security benefits. That sits at 41% of total Social Security beneficiaries. That will this will take it to 88%. 88%. But it is temporary, and it expires at the end of 28, which means that, once again, we're going to have this circus that we just got through going through again in 4 years, where all this stuff's expiring, and there's this fire drill to see how to make it permanent, if there's any interest in doing that. Tim and McGee says, soldiers sacrificed their lives for complete strangers. So true. Mike from Columbus, I got an F in a writing class because I disagree with the viewpoints. It was an assignment to critique. Oh, the views, viewpoints. It was an assignment to critique the view. I remember the 70s doom and gloomers were predicting we would be under 3 feet of ice by 2000, says Tim from Tupelo.
Oh, yeah, Leonard Nimoy was the narrator.
I remember watching
a documentary about the coming ice age.
I remember watching that thing. Hey, guys, let's talk about the initiative process. Larry and Rankin, that was for the speaker. Well, that's easy to really discuss because the House passed it. And this year they said, you know, we're not even going to try because we've counted the votes in the Senate and there's no interest there. So this is a matter of getting the Senate on board to restore the ballot initiative in the state. The speaker's on board. People sleep peaceably in their beds at night because rough men stand ready to do violence on their behalf. Thank you for our freedom. Absolutely true. Have you heard when no tax on Social Security will kick in, says Bobby from Monticello. Bobby, that didn't make the cut. What made the cut is what we were just talking about, is the increase in the standard deduction for all those over 65. To an additional $6,000 on their standard deduction. That's only good for 4 years, by the way. But so that will affect, again, it more than doubles the number whose Social Security income will not be subject to federal income tax. The CBO did the math on that. Unfortunately, Gerard, some of these protesters from the 60s are in the legislatures and Congress. Rhino talks about all the time. And
that's pretty much all that's left at Democrat protests is the older of the silvered hair and people that shouldn't even be here.
And I'm from that era as well. Some of them are a little bit older than me, but I didn't get the memo on that. I mean, I think I was saved, if you will, by two fantastic parents. And if you didn't have that, the benefit of growing up in a loving, nurturing home with two great parents that have their act together and imparted that wisdom on you.
Then you get swept up in the stupidity of mob mentality.
Great way to put it. Totally great way to put it.
Because the average IQ of a mob is half of its dumbest member.
Yep. Let's see here, man. Thomas has sent about 8,000 messages this morning already. I'm not looking at all the dumb memes, honestly. Then be that politician to replace either the worthless Mississippi senators. I wouldn't call them worthless. And Thomas, I certainly appreciate the thought there. I don't think that's accurate. I've been critical of three votes Senator Wicker cast, and I'm sure he and his staff know that, and I got my reasons for that. But that,
somehow Thomas doesn't think someone like Rand Paul is worthless.
Yeah, he's worthless because he really. I think part of the problem there is that he's not the right guy to carry the message to influence others. Would you agree with that? That's what's lacking there. He's not the kind of figure that is needed to really carry that message. It's not that he's wrong in pointing out some of the stuff.
You mean it's hard to swallow the bitter pill that we have too much government spending when he spends government spending on all of his stickers
so
and
correct.
Flyers and stuff for his cart when he decides to complain about government spending?
So, absolutely so correct. So I go into the beer store on the 3rd, and they had already reprogrammed for the grocery tax. Coke, Snickers, chips are included in the break. Petty Officer Scott Ruskin writes us and says that.
No, that was Scott Ruskin was the Coast Guard
oh, thank
guy
you.
That saved the kids in Texas.
About. Coming right back.
Poly up a Mississippi.
Are we going to do this?
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Keep rolling. 3, 2, 1.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It is Middays, Super Talk Mississippi. Don't forget the 13th annual Palmer Home for Children Radiothon. That's this Thursday here on Super Talk Mississippi. Every year there are children across Mississippi that need a loving home, and many times these children are caught in unimaginable circumstances. That's why we need your help. You'll learn how Palmer Home for Children serves vulnerable children. It's a faith-based organization that does not take government money. That's why we need your help. We want you to tune in. Join us for the 13th annual Palmer Home for Children Radiothon. That's happening Thursday here on Super Talk Mississippi. How long are you going to be on the air?
6 hours.
Woo, 6 hours. And then you and me, we got four. We get kicked off at 9. It's a 9-1 special edition of Middays from Palmer Home for Children. And then the boys are going to be at SEC Media Days. Man, that's coming up next week.
Yep, in Atlanta.
Wow. And then we're going to roll into the Neshoba County Fair. I hope you guys will check us out. We'll be broadcasting live on the 31st, Thursday the 31st, from the fair. And right when our broadcast concludes, I got to hottail it over to the stage and put the sticks in the hands and play a little music with the house band. Looking forward to that. We've been practicing, got another one. We got three more left, three or four practices left, trying to get it all down. Can you address the tax increase on gas? This is on the C Spire text line on the 662. When there's lottery money going, is it going to bonuses and pay raises? Lottery money, just so you'll know, the first $80 million of net proceeds produced by the Mississippi Lottery Corporation does go to the State Highway Fund. The budget's $1.4 billion. So it's about 5%, just a tad over 5% of the total budget. It's certainly a nice little additional amount of money that the lottery provides for the Department of Transportation, but it's 5% of the total. And yes, it does get invested in road and bridge maintenance and construction, which is continuous. That never ends. I got to tell you guys, I have all the faith in the world in Executive Director Brad White. I do think, as you heard the speaker say, I agree with him, he runs a tight ship. Honestly, if someone not as competent as Brad were in charge, and I've met lots of his management team as well, had the privilege of speaking to those guys a couple of months ago, I would be concerned. The fact is, the cost of roads and bridges, like everything else, has gone up. And the other thing is, we don't seem to be attracting as many third-party contractors to participate in the bidding process as there once was. I'm not sure what the reason is for that. Maybe they don't like getting beat up by the bid process, but I would never support ending the competitive bid process for those procurements. And that's where most of the money goes. It goes to third parties. Unless you wanted to take it all in-house, I dare say it'd be a lot less efficient and cost more money. So I think we're on the right track. I think that's the right approach.
To put those numbers in a little bit of a different perspective, the total number of miles in the Mississippi State Highway System is 11,164.467 miles. So 1,165 miles. 1,164 if you round down, but we'll say 1,165.
Right.
5% of that, So the amount that would be covered by the lottery money is 558 miles.
Right. That's nothing. And they're good about publishing and announcing, disclosing where those monies are being put to work. So it's a little supplemental amount of money to take care of lots of things that we wouldn't be able to without the lottery. But it's not a substitute for what a 3 cents ultimate 9 cents per gallon tax will generate in the state. That's significant. So Brad White and his team say that really to keep up with our needs, we need an additional $300 million a year in revenue. I'd like to see us do something. I've shared this with Brad. To get the dang lights working, you know, they say thieves keep stealing the copper out of the big light standards. Well, it's a waste of money to put up all these standards and then not have them illuminated. Sure would like to see that situation addressed. And I know Brad said they're working on something new, hopefully, that would guard against this theft. It's incredible to me that they go dig up the copper out of the dang ground or in the poles or whatever they're doing there and take it with them. Is your band going to make it on Super Talk YouTube? I'm sure there'll be some folks there recording us that will go put it up on YouTube. That's DJ and Summit. Thomas, I know you say that our Republican senator's fiscal irresponsibility threatens my children's future, so I have every right to consider them worthless. Just here's a question for you. When do you think, at what point, where does our debt have to be for your children's future to be at risk? Because I got to tell you, those in the Congress will tell you, well, look, inflation's really not a big thing, and we keep adding to the debt every day, and that's the biggest risk. I happen to think that's a problem as well, but that would be their response. We're out of here today. It's Monday. That means Ricky Matthews, Super Talk Outdoors is next. Back with you tomorrow. Stay safe, and God bless everyone.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.